What is it that makes the British seaside sinister? Why does it seem to attract so many killers? Is it the fact that the tide washes away their sins? Is it the fact that it's the end of the line? There's nothing overly frightening about a big wheel or a carousel. But what is undeniable is that the British seaside attracts and has always attracted death and murder. Hello, I'm Geoffrey Wonsall. I write about crime, true crime. And in this new series, I want you to join me on a journey to the cliff's edge, where land meets the sea and where life meets death.
Whilst some may consider my opinions to be bold, they have been formed after writing bestsellers about real killers for the past 30 years and staring evil in the face.
For make no mistake, there is something sinister about our British seaside towns. On the surface, they're all funfairs, candy floss and breezy promenades. But by digging a little deeper in the sand, we uncover an underworld of misfits and misfeasance, murder and mayhem. And reveal the dark lives of the most deadly coastal killers to ever stalk our shores. In today's episode, we travel to the spectacular Scottish coastline, where the scenery was marred by one of the most senseless and brutal killings in this series.
Vitas Plotnikas
was a soldier in the Red Army, and there's no doubt whatever that it gave him an appetite for killing. Belligerent, big, bullying, there was nothing about him that was subtle. What he wanted most of all was his own way, and he was prepared to take it and get it at all costs, at any cost. He served in Afghanistan with the Red Army, but left. He had been born in Lithuania. He wasn't a Russian in that sense, but he had something of a dislike for his fellow Lithuanians. He was also a man who could not stand to be crossed. After leaving the Red Army, he found himself in Germany. In 2001, he got into a fight in a bar and, in an ensuing brawl, killed a man. Not all that unexpected if you think that this was a soldier who'd grown used to killing in Afghanistan. He wasn't afraid of it. He wasn't afraid of death, but he also liked to inflict pain. The German killing in 2001 saw him sentenced to 7 years in a German prison. When he is finally released, he does not stay in Germany. He finds himself in Brechin, in Scotland, among a community of Lithuanians, many of whom work in the farms and send money back to their families.
It was a big influx of Eastern European workers at that time, and they very quickly gained a reputation for being reliable, trustworthy, and very, very hardworking. And they were involved in things like fruit picking, potato dressing, packing, just any job. But they, as I say, they were, you know, the farm industry around our area was crying out for people like them, and they made a very, very successful living here.
Imagine a massive, bull-headed, broad-shouldered, close-shaven bully of a man who wants nothing more than to intimidate anyone who comes across his path. That is Plitnikus. He is a man of anger, a man of determined to destroy anyone who disagrees with him. There is nothing about him that is conciliatory, that is empathetic. He simply wants his own way at any cost, regardless, and in the end is prepared to kill to get it.
If you were a movie maker and you wanted to select a killer, Vitus Plitnikus would be a typecast pair. He had the look. He would fit the bill if he was auditioning for that role.
He had been a criminal for some time in his own country and apparently had been charged and convicted of manslaughter in Germany. So we've got a guy who is criminal from a long-standing criminal background. How is he making his money? And it would appear that he was doing various activities, some which may have been criminal.
Plitnikus, I know that he was a persistent disqualified driver in Brechin. He'd forever be chased by the local police in his car. He was caught more than once. I don't know whether he'd be up to, you know, whether he was stealing or shoplifting, I have no idea, but he certainly was well known to the Brechin, the police in Brechin at the time, as being a particular menace.
Whilst working on the farms, Plitnikus befriended another young Lithuanian by the name of Alexander Skirda.
Skirda lived in the same building as a popular young woman called Jolanta Bledarte.
She was saving all the money she'd made from fruit picking to send home to her family back in Lithuania.
She seemed to be just a pleasant, unassuming, hardworking and extremely diligent young woman. I knew personally one of the farmers who employed her, and she made a very, very good impression on him.
She was clearly coming to Britain to make a life, to improve her lifestyle and her income. I would imagine that she would have probably had a different lifestyle to his. There's no obvious connection between the two of them, other than the fact they're Lithuanian, living in a foreign country.
As far as I'm concerned, the main motive for the crime would be to gain money from her account that she'd saved up over the period she was in Scotland, purely and simply just greed. She was here just to earn some money, you know. I think she'd made it plain that at some point in the near future she was going back home with the money that she'd accrued. And this is possibly why they decided on this course of action. And Skirda, the younger one, he stayed in the same block of flats as her. And I think they were kind of quite friendly. So he must have come by some information that This was going to take place. She was going to leave, and she had money in her account, and this is what was the attraction was for the pair of them.
I think Jolanta would have been an honest young woman, and perhaps Alexandros, being a younger chap, they would have been of a similar age, and she may just have been too open. It was known that she was saving up money to send home to her family, and she probably just gave away too much that then leaked out and sowed the seed in probably the mind of Vitas.
She is absolutely innocent. She has done nothing wrong to anyone, except she's made the mistake of bragging to Skirdas that she has £10,000 squirreled away in a bank account in Scotland. That is the bait that costs her her life. In the early morning of the 29th of March, 2008, Plotnikas and his accomplice Skirda burst into the room of Jolanta. He says to her, without a moment's hesitation, be silent. All they have in mind is to steal the money they think she has, £10,000, reputedly. Plotnikas demanded to know what her PIN number was. He searched the room, eventually found not one, but two bank cards. She, with great presence of mind, gave him the wrong PIN number the first time. He rushed out, went to the local ATM, tried to cash the maximum he could on her bank card, and it came back as false. Now he's truly angry. He goes back to her room and says, if you don't give me the right PIN number, I'm going to kill you. Imagine the torment of this 35-year-old woman, hard-working, saved for her family, sent money back to Lithuania for her father who was ill. She was doing nothing wrong at all, and she was picked upon by these two savages, led by Plotnikas, who wanted nothing more than to make money out of her. At the second time of asking, she gave him the right PIN number, thinking, or perhaps hoping, that he would save her life. Tragically, it didn't.
You work through these things as to, had they gone to the cash line, and had they get, now, I mean, at a cash line, you can only withdraw hundreds of pounds. Our understanding was that there was thousands of pounds, possibly into more than £10,000 that they believed that she had. I don't know how long had they been able to go back and forward to the cash machine, how long they would have drained that account, and ultimately what would have happened to Jolanta had they been able to drain the account. We'll never know, because I believe the frustration was not being able to get the money. I think Jolanta had either given them a wrong PIN number, or they couldn't get enough money quickly enough, and things then escalated just out of control.
It's an act of the most incredible savagery. But it's even worse than that. Not just simply is he stealing her money, not just simply is he keeping her hostage, not just simply is he intimidating her beyond words. Imagine what she must have felt. She would have been terrified, utterly, completely terrified. And then he smothers her. The horrifying death of Jolanta saw her overwhelmed, smothered to death. As is always the case with murderers and their telling of the truth, we may never know the full extent of the role that Skirda played alongside Plotnikas on that terrible day.
but he was as responsible for her death as his partner.
She finally, tragically, gives up her life. But her ordeal doesn't even end there. The two of them take her body from the room that she has in the communal house. They take her to the bathroom and Plotnikas dismembers her. He saws her head off. He cuts her hands off. He puts the head into, of all things, a carrier bag. He takes the head, believe it or not, on a bus from the flat in Brechin to Arbroath on the coast. It almost defies imagination. He sits on the bus with the bag in front of him and Skerda sitting beside him, and they go to Arbroath. And what do? They throw the bag with the head and hands weighted with stones, which they collected from the beach, into the sea, thinking that thereby they'd committed the perfect crime. The following day, they go back and collect the torso in a suitcase, take that through the streets of Brechin, again on a bus, back to Arbroath, and they throw that into the harbour, thinking that no one will ever find it.
People have this idea that you throw a body in the sea and it'll sink. It'll only sink if you put enough weight on it to bring it down. He clearly didn't do that in this case. He disposed of it in the sea, and nature, taking the course it does, will bring everything back onto the shore.
As the Scots would say, the best laid schemes of mice and men off Gang of Glay, and this is the case in this crime. Everything that they thought to create the perfect crime went wrong. They throw the head and hands into the sea, weighted with stones. But within 2 days, it washes up on the beach, and two sisters discover the head. I cannot conceive of what they must have thought. It is truly horrifying. And one reason why this crime is always called the head on the beach.
The way it was reported to me was that there was a couple of children had been playing on the beach. Quite young kids, I think they were. They had been playing on the beach and had, whether they just felt it with their hands or whatever, but they had formed an opinion between them that it was definitely a human head. And told their mother, who subsequently contacted the police on that particular day, which was the 1st of April 2008, was requested by the control room to attend an area of South Street in Arbroath, at the beach there, where two uniformed officers had spoken to two children who'd said that they'd found what they thought was a human head on the beach. I treated this with a degree of scepticism because of the date, because I had remembered from several years ago that some students at St Andrews had placed a pair of hands from a cadaver that they'd been working on at the university and put them inside a letterbox for the postman to find, which a bizarre thing to do, but I thought, it was going through my mind at that time when we were going to the call, this could possibly be a prank because it's April Fool's Day. However, on getting there, had a look, approached it, and I could see human hair and flesh, which convinced me that it was a real head. There was no doubt in my mind that's what it was, and it was obviously part of a horrific act that had taken place somewhere. At that point, I contacted the control room again and said, I'm pretty sure this is what it is, and asked the assistance of the identification branch, who deal with serious incidents, like murder, for example. I also asked for my two senior officers, DCI McMillan and DI Gordon Cryle, to attend, because it was a murder scene to me. I'd taken some pictures of the locus, and after a few minutes, the two senior officers did arrive on the beach along with the identification branch. Grant Thompson, who had a look at it, and he was pretty convinced what it was, but unfortunately one of the senior officers, the DI Cryle, decided that it wasn't real. And we had a bit of a discussion about that, because he was adamant that it was plastic. Obviously, he was taking the date into consideration. However, he was eventually convinced that it was real, and the whole identification branch circus started, and the beach was cordoned off, and various other inquiries were made regarding it. Whilst we were on the beach, one of the uniformed officers, who was quite young in service, Alan Ramshaw, he was a bit upset by what we'd found, as we all were, but he was particularly upset. And my colleague, DC Crichton, had said to him, why don't you go and search another part of the beach, just to sort of take his mind off it. But unfortunately, he found another black plastic bag which had a pair of hands in it, which belonged to the deceased. That's quite alarming.
Another irony is that the moment the police saw the photograph of the head, they recognised her, because she'd acted as a translator for Police Scotland in a crime, a robbery, involving Lithuanians. So not only did they know almost at once who the victim was, they had a pretty good idea who the perpetrators might be. Skurda had been the person who'd identified the victim as a target originally. They'd shared a flat together, he knew her well, and it was he who suggested that she was a target because she boasted to him that she saved £10,000. Yolanta was a very reliable employee. The agency she worked for depended on her. When she didn't appear, which was most uncharacteristic, the person who was asked where she was Skurda, who made the excuse of saying that she'd gone off with some Polish workers. It was, of course, a lie.
She was working as a fruit picker, she was working on a farm, she's going to be part of this transit population that's moving from one farm to another. Therefore, there would not be a record of what she was doing, she would just be drifting through the farmlands from one farm to another. That was also to his advantage, that because she would not have been missed, that if she disappeared, it's because she's moved on to another job, not she's been killed or murdered or anything like that. So nobody would be particularly bothered about her disappearing for 2 or 3 days.
Skurda had calculated that Yolanta had very few friends and was very hard working. Who was going to miss her? Because, like a lot of migrant communities, there is not a great record of who is where at what point, and they are naturally transient. That is what these two murderers banked on to save them from justice. It was a terrible, terrible mistake.
Plitnikas and Skurda naively thought that by dismembering Yolanta's body and disposing it in the sea, they had erased anything that linked them to the murder. But they had not reckoned on Yolanta's head being washed up on the beach, her face still visibly identifiable.
A photograph of the head was taken, which was kept in the incident room as part of the inquiry. And one of the female officers, she had actually spoken to this woman about 3 or 4 weeks before, because Jolanta had helped the police in being an interpreter for an incident that happened 3 weeks, 4 weeks previous to this. And she had said that she looked really like that girl, Jolanta Bloditi, who she'd spoken to. I think the inquiries were made with the caravan park where she worked, or somebody that knew her in the Brechin area, and that she was positively identified as being Jolanta.
She had worked for them as a translator for fellow Lithuanians charged or arrested with offences. The complication was that there was no obvious suspect. There are a large number of migrant workers, between 30 and 50,000 in that part of Scotland. It was a well-known fact that they sent their money back to families in Lithuania.
The head on the beach now had a name, but the police were no closer to knowing who had murdered her. The main evidence the police had were Jolanta's body parts. These formed the central line of their investigation to try and determine what had happened.
When body parts are found together, there's obviously a presumption that they're from the same body. We hope they are. And in this case, there was no suggestion that they were from separate bodies. So, yeah, that was our working idea was that these were from the same body, yes. The rest of the body was recovered by divers, I understand, in the Arbroath Harbour area, and they had recovered the rest of the body in a suitcase. We'd already examined the head and neck and the face for the presence of injuries. We'd examined the hands for any defensive-type injuries. We'd examined the margins where the dismemberment had occurred. But the rest of the examination, in fact, most of the good stuff was in the head and neck, and the rest of the torso didn't really add much to our understanding of what had happened. There wasn't much else to find. Well, we had a few clues, but there was not, the findings were quite subtle. There was some bruising inside the lips and some small lacerations inside the lips and some grazes on the nose, which, when you put that together, points to some form of mechanical asphyxia with a hand or a pillow or some compressive force over the mouth and nose and over the airways. So that was our working diagnosis. Then we put it all together, if you like, in terms of the head and neck findings with the torso findings, and formulated our report and our conclusions based on the story which had emerged and the totality of the findings, albeit that the main findings had been in the head and neck from the first find. Our findings were really quite subtle, but we were thinking that the findings in the lips and the nose would be in keeping with mechanical asphyxia, and then the story which emerged from the police was of binding and gagging of the hands and wrists and also around the mouth as well with tape, and that fit very well with our findings of subtle asphyxia. It seems to me that some criminals seem to think that dismembering a body will enable them to get away with a crime, and in fact it just seems to create more evidence, and it seems to be counterproductive. When we're looking at the margins of the hands and wrists and of the neck, we were thinking of a sharp-edged instrument, obviously, but there were some marks elsewhere that gave the weapon away as a serrated blade, because the serrations on the blade, the teeth of the serrations, at certain angles can create scratch marks which give away the weapon. Dismemberment is more than every day. It's a rarity, thank goodness. But homicide is something we've got to be prepared for. When the sad stories which are behind the homicides, we can't help but be affected by them, but we have to put it aside and be professional and try not to let those things affect us. But sometimes it does creep in, but by and large, we try to put that aside. That's not our business. We're there to identify the science and the medicine and not to get involved in the psychology.
As the police tried to piece together Jolanta's final moments, the murderous union formed between Plitnikas and Skurda was beginning to show signs of cracking.
A little lost boy
working in a new adventure in another country, working, making friends, new area. I don't think anyone will ever know what duress Alexandros may have been under or what influence he may have been under. But there's no doubt in my mind that Vitas Plotnikas was the driving force behind this crime. No doubt.
The difficulty he had was that his accomplice, Alexandra Skirda, younger, only still 19, began to get nervous, very nervous. He started to think that Plotnikas was going to drop him in it. He was going to place the blame fairly on squarely on the young man's shoulders. Now, the young man did not want to accept that. In fact, he was terrified. And it was he who eventually blew the whistle on Plotnikas. With Yolanta's body returned to her parents, Vitas Plotnikas and his associate and accomplice, Skirda, stood trial for her murder. Skirda pleaded guilty and, through his interpreter, told the court so. Plotnikas, by comparison, pleaded not guilty. How is almost beyond imagination. But what happened then was that Skirda went on to give elaborate, detailed evidence of the crime that Plotnikas had committed. There could be no explanation for that crime beyond a desire for money. How much money, what price would you put on a human life, on the life of a young woman? £100, £200, £3? Because that's all that Vitas Plotnikas got from killing poor, innocent Yolanta. Plotnikas is, without any question, a monster of the worst possible kind.
One of the problems with partnerships in crime is when the two of them are arrested, one will normally be offered an escape route, and the weak of the two will take the escape route and turn Queen's evidence. It's to their advantage, and that's what the police play on. It's very rare for two people involved in the killing to actually both get convicted at the same rate and the same sentence, because one of them will normally weaken the other.
Alexandros gave evidence very early on in the trial, and it was incredibly harrowing. It was incredibly matter of fact, but it was incredibly harrowing. And we weren't sure whether Vitas would then give evidence. The suspicions were that he would not, and they proved correct. We had a number of interpreters in court. It was a fairly elongated trial because each question had to be asked. Each of the accused had an interpreter. Quite often the witnesses were Eastern European, Lithuanian, whatever, so there was an interpreter there. So it was a lengthy trial. It was quite chilling, actually. The interpreter that Vitas had was a girl who could have been Yolanta. She was an absolute ringer for Yolanta, and I find that quite unsettling to see her sitting close to him every day and having to whisper in his ear as she was translating the questions from the witness box, and Vitas just... He was completely, he just was completely sort of detached during the trial. No emotion whatsoever. I don't recall any emotion. I don't recall him, in court trials that you cover, if accused disagree or if they have they will shake their heads or whatever. Nothing from Vitas during that trial. Nothing at all.
And she's a lot of money.
Gerda knew when he was giving the evidence, such as he was, that the depth of trouble and the length of time in prison that he would be facing. He didn't try to put blame on Vitas. He just gave his evidence and told the court what had happened.
Farmers from Lithuania picked vegetables and we found out this woman had...
The thing that I remember was Alexandros detailing how they... And he put it as simply as, we cut her up, no more, no less. And then I remember him say, he was questioned as to what they did then. And I think the prosecutor was perhaps looking for him to elaborate on transporting the pieces of the body. And instead, Alexandros, I remember saying, we then had a cigarette. And it was just abhorrent, you know. You just couldn't believe what you were hearing.
One crucial piece of evidence presented at the trial was related to the tidal patterns at Arbroath Harbour, where the body parts were found by the police.
I went to see the harbour master at Arbroath and asked him about the tidal movements, how something would end up there, and he assured me that if something had been thrown from the harbour wall at Arbroath, then the chances of it landing up there were pretty high. So I hadn't gone any great distance, which was a great... It was a great find, that, the fact that, you know, you knew probably, in all probability, where it had come from. So thereafter, myself and DC Crichton, we were put on investigations regarding closed-circuit television. Both the Angus CCTV for the whole of the area, and subsequently we did manage to get some footage of the two now accused, Plignitis and Skirda. They'd actually got a bus from Brechin to a little village called Freecombe, where they changed buses to get a bus to Arbroath. And there was footage which was never ever used. There was footage of them sitting on the bus with the head in a little bag on the seat beside them. We then found the CCTV footage of them alighting from the bus at Catherine Street in Arbroath and making their way down towards the harbour area, which is exactly where it was the head was thrown in the water.
CCTV was also important in revealing how the killers disposed of Yolanta's torso, once again in the harbour.
They were given a lift down to Arbroath a day or a day and a half after the initial find, where they'd taken the body in a suitcase with wheels on it, a trolley suitcase, and they were dropped off in the middle of Arbroath and followed them on the CCTV. They actually walked down the high street and walked right past the Sheriff Court with the body in the suitcase. And they were then seen to go back down towards the harbour area, but they had disposed of it by throwing it over the wall into the water on the other side, as opposed to where they threw the head.
After pleading guilty, Skirda was sentenced to 20 years in jail. Vitas Plitnikas, by comparison, was sentenced to 28 years in jail. I would have thought an entirely reasonable, but perhaps rather lenient, sentence. Plitnikas was horrified, and once in jail, started writing letters to the press. "How can I understand your laws," he wrote, "if for the murder of a small child in this country, you get 10 years, and yet I get 28.
His self-pitying letters were rightly rejected. After 5 years of serving his sentence in Scotland, he was deported back to Lithuania to serve out the remainder of his sentence. But he continued to write letters to Scotland in a bid to win sympathy and leniency.
Late November, early December 2015, a letter arrived in our office, and it was, on the back of it was, Vytas Plytnikas and the name or the address of the prison in Lithuania. It stretched to 15 pages, and through one of my colleagues in the office, we had it translated, and it was Vytas suggesting that, perversely, that Jolanta had been almost to blame for her own death, and that he had been unfairly treated and that his belongings had been taken. And it wasn't, in one way, it was protesting innocence, but that was impossible to match up with what we had heard in the court and, you know, his lack of evidence and his conduct up to that point.
He didn't deny the murder. He just moaned about the fact that he had a long sentence. He thought he should have had a shorter sentence. He's now been sent back to Vilnius, which is in Lithuania, the capital of Lithuania, and he's serving his sentence there, and he's still complaining about the length of sentence. He was very dismissive of his victim and feels that he should have only got a short sentence because her life wasn't worth it.
Imagine how Jolanta's family must have felt. Her father said, "My beautiful daughter was thrown away like a bag of rubbish." It's impossible not to sympathise with him. Even more strange is the fact that Jolanta's grandmother had a premonition that something dreadful was going to happen to her granddaughter. She was to say later, and I quote, "I had a very bad dream the day she left. To me, it was a sign that dead people were escorting her out of the house, a premonition that something dreadful was going to happen." Tragically for Jolanta, something dreadful did indeed happen. She fell into the clutches of Vytas Plytnikas.
One of the overriding feelings in Angus was that the county, you know, it's a quiet rural community. The shock, the depth of shock, as I say, even though it didn't involve Angus residents, the depth of shock was extreme. And I think Angus just wanted to be able to close a chapter. Although they could never forget, I think they just wanted to put the horror of this behind them and move on.
It's something that'll never leave you. You'll always be haunted by the fact that you saw that head on the beach and it was somebody's child, you know. It was really terrible. In my opinion, nobody will forget that. Every April Fool's Day, I certainly don't forget it.
"Where is the honesty?" he wrote from jail. "Let us have a look here, Mr. Judge. What kind of sentence do freaks get?" If anyone deserves to be called a freak, it is Vytas Plytnikas. He acted in a depraved, callous, cruel, foul manner towards an utterly innocent, hard-working young woman who wanted to do nothing more than to help her family in Lithuania. Plytnikas is, and always will be, a monster.